Okay, yes.
Where do we get the podcast? Where do we go?
From our website, and they should be available. Today's class should be available not much later than Wednesday morning. I'll turn this over to our one of our IT people tomorrow morning or tonight, and they'll get it up as quickly as they can. There are a few of us who, you know, there's no requirement that you do it, but again, we're searching for things that we know will work for people. Speaking of which, Massachusetts is an unusual state where you can't record someone without their permission. And so if you determine that this is going to be helpful for you and the teacher doesn't podcast, then you're going to have to ask that person's permission to record the class. Okay. And that's a violation of state law. Technically, what Linda Tripp did to Monica Lewinsky was a violation of Maryland law, and I never understood why she wasn't prosecuted for that. So it may have been the politics, but what the hell do I know? Let us start with our first case. That's what you're here for, so let us start. At the end of the evening, I'll collect your briefs on the Roken case. And then tomorrow, I will have my administrative assistant send out to you a sample brief on Roken, but I'll collect it. I'll only do this twice. I'll do it for the start of criminal procedure, and then we will do it for the start of criminal law. So that, and you should brief every case. Part of what you're going to find is that you can do it faster after a while, but you need to brief every case. You need to extract as much information from the cases as you can. In your materials, you've got Roken versus California. And so,
can I ask a general question
about
the brief format? Is the purpose mostly to create a study guide for ourselves?
Yes.
So is the formality of it, can we do it in that line form of sentence fragments, or are you looking for more like academic style writing and formatting? Or?
There is some freedom within this structure, but having said that, there are certain questions that you're going to have to be able to answer. And so as we go through Roken, you know, one of the questions will be, well, what are the facts? And so your brief is going to have to outline the facts. Then secondly, there'll be, what is the issue? And we'll have to work on issue framing because, you know, you could actually state the issue in one or two words, but not say anything that's unique about this case. So there is some freedom in the rule of law, but you want to be careful. It's interesting that you should ask the question. I don't mean to be rude. When I put these materials together, I originally did not have a sample brief, because the sample brief that we've used over the years is one that I don't like. I don't particularly care for the format. I think that your briefs ought to identify the critical facts. You ought to be able to state the issue with legal terminology, that's driven by the facts, and then you need to be able to state the rule of law. And the rule of law doesn't have to be fact-based, because frequently the rule of law is a general principle that's going to be applied in different places. And then in terms of the analysis, some folks say, well, what was the rationale that the court offered? I actually prefer to see you talk about the arguments that were made. And so, you know, I'm not sure whether the format says that, you know. And so that's ultimately what's going to be most useful in terms of preparation for class. Think about each case as though you had to argue both sides. And sometimes the arguments for one side are going to be more persuasive, but that doesn't mean that you ignore the arguments for the other side. So that's a long-winded answer. But I originally did not include this, and so I got an email from the university saying, didn't you mean to include this? And so it was asked by someone who's not a lawyer, who's never taught law, and I wasn't, you know, I'm on vacation. I wasn't going to take the time to explain to this person why I didn't include it. So if it turns out that you're, you know, that's why I want to collect the briefs, so I'll see whether you're in the right place or not. And the fact that you couldn't conform it to the format that you were given, I don't care.
Oh, no, I thought the suggested format would be for shaping the critical, you know, yeah. a way of looking at the back and forth, but I'm wondering if the final result of what we should be handing in is for a presentation
style? No, this is for you. The brief, there's nothing more personal than a brief. It's a tool for you to use in the classroom. But as I said, there are certain things that it ought to contain.
I have one other question about that. So in the discussion of the facts, should we be careful in saying things like allegedly this happened or just stating things as they're written and how?
That's an interesting question. I don't think it's necessary to talk about alleged. The facts, unless the person who drafted the opinion uses the word alleged. Okay. Yes, sir?
Now, following up on that, you talk facts. Is it preferred that you have a narrative or is bulletizing the facts, or is that something that whether it works for you?
I think that truly is it, what works for you. For some folks, doing a narrative will work. For others, it will be a bullet. And part is going to be what your other training and experience has been. I can do both. And frequently, I will show up to a lecture with an index card with four or five words on it. And that's all I need. So it depends upon what works for you. But you want to be careful about excluding anything. It's a little early for you to try to figure out what's relevant and what isn't. Let's sort of work through that. Let's assume that everything is there for a reason initially, and then we can begin to drop stuff out. Yes.
And the last question was asked, can they be interchanged with, for example, procedural history? And that was from Paolo versus Alabama. It seems to me like a lot of the facts were part of what happened in the procedure. So how would you, is there a
way? Well, yes. Typically, when the question is what is the procedural history, typically what we're asking is what mechanisms or what steps has this case gone through? So there was an arrest, there was an arraignment, and there was a trial. A verdict was rendered, and the defendant is appealing from that verdict. Typically, in these kinds of cases, that's That's the procedural history. But we'll see that there are some cases where there's a little bit more. The defendant is appealing because of a particular reason. These cases come to us usually for one of, I think, four reasons, it's pretty safe to say. One is that the defendant is alleging that a particular constitutional right has been violated. Sometimes the constitutional right is one where the court failed to recognize the right because they were interpreting the Constitution too narrowly or too broadly. So, you know, you get those kinds of cases. Oftentimes you will get cases where there is insufficient evidence to support a conviction. And it's actually why I'm beginning with due process. Another way that this stuff arises is if the judge has not, part of what happens prior to a trial, what happened in the Sal DeMacy case today was that on Friday there were closing statements, arguments, whatever you want to call them. And now it was up to the judge to instruct the jury as to what rules of law were going to be applicable in this case. And the DeMacy case really is about an interpretation of the rule of law. The U.S. Supreme Court several years ago reversed the conviction of Skelling. You may recall there was a period of time when a number of big companies were falling apart because of bad accounting practices. And Skelling, who's a graduate of the Harvard Business School, was convicted, and his conviction was overturned essentially on that little word intent. And the Supreme Court said that where you're alleging that certain types of conduct essentially was a quid pro quo, you scratch my back, I'll scratch yours. You have to prove that there was criminal intent. And because politicians are supposed to provide services for their constituents, the fact that a politician provided a service to a constituent doesn't mean that he or she is guilty of anything. And so what will happen with the DeMacy case is if he is found guilty, that issue will end up being appealed, that the judge didn't properly instruct the jury on the rule of law. And so we shall see. I assume that Judge Wolf was very careful, but that's what it's going to be. And you're going to see this oftentimes in the cases, that even though you've got the rule of law, there may be a twist to how that rule of law is presented. Or sometimes you have judges who just think they can be creative. I tried a case years ago where a judge decided to use analogies to explain what reasonable doubt meant. And he used some off-the-wall stuff. There's actually judges are given a handbook. These are the instructions that you ought to give on reasonable doubt. Don't make it up. Read it. Read it to the jury. so there can be no question about this. And this judge simply declined. He thought he was smarter than the book. And the case ended up getting tipped or reversed because he had screwed up on the instruction of reasonable doubt. So, you know, you'll see cases kicked out because of insufficient evidence, which is the violation of due process. You'll see cases get kicked out because the trial judge has failed to give a proper jury instruction. So those are some of the things to look for. So that might be part of the procedural history. Because it doesn't necessarily tell you the issue, it just tells you procedurally what happened. The issue will be, why was that instruction flawed? Okay. So, but we'll go through it. You'll get through it, mastered through practice. So, I'm sorry, what's your name again?
Brenna.
Why don't we start with you and Rokin? Just want to point out that the case, the caption for the case, Rokin versus California, tells you a couple of things. First of all, it tells you that Rokin lost, okay? Because Rokin is the petitioner here. He is the person seeking relief. He is the person alleging that something has gone wrong, and so he must prove to the U.S. Supreme Court what it was that went wrong. The defendant in this case will be the state of California. They will have to respond to Rokin's allegations that something went wrong. So that's the citation. And the citation tells you where, if you want to read this entire opinion, where to go. So this is, you're given the United States Reporter citation, the page, the volume, and the page number, and the year. And then frequently you'll be given other citations as well when we talk about cases, because frequently cases are reported in several different places. So, having said that about the Rokin case, why don't you tell us the facts?
So I said on July 1st, 1949, three Los Angeles County deputy sheriffs, without a warrant but with, quote, some information about the petitioner dealing narcotics, entered Rokin's residence and found him in his second story bedroom. On a nightstand were two capsules which Rokin immediately swallowed after the officers noticed them. The officers attempted to extract the capsules themselves. It was a physical struggle, which included attempting to force open his mouth and even jumping on the petitioner. When their attempts proved unsuccessful, they handcuffed him, brought him to a hospital where he was then strapped to an operating table and had a tooth forced down his throat. He was given an emetic solution where the contents of his stomach yielded two capsules. These capsules were then tested to reveal they contained morphine.
Okay.
And that was just the... The facts of just the initial case.
Yeah. Procedurally, what do you, can you tell
the,
what happened here?
From that point, the chief evidence in the case was the test result of the two capsules retrieved from the stomach. The petitioner objected to this evidence, which was overruled despite the means by which it was obtained. He was convicted and incarcerated for 60 days. The conviction was affirmed by the District Court of Appeal, and the Supreme Court of California denied the petition for a hearing.
I mean, that's a terrific start. It was Brenna, right?
Brenna,
I'm sorry. People laugh at me because I screw up names, but eventually I get them right.
Brenna, I got you.
The procedural history in this case, you summarized, I think you want to be a little more focused. and just a tad more. And so that, by tad more, I mean that the trial court, at trial, the defendant argued that this evidence should not be admissible. The trial judge overruled that objection, allowed the evidence to be admitted. The defendant was subsequently convicted and sentenced to whatever you said. And yeah, and then the defendant appealed to the district court. In this case, it's the federal district, probably the federal district court. Also, apparently appealed to the Supreme Court of California. And appears to have lost in both cases.
Well, the second one, we didn't hear it.
Yeah, okay. Whatever. Sometimes not hearing is the same thing as not being successful, so he didn't get any relief there. And that would be a more precise way of stating it.
Question in that regard?
Yes.
Just an aside, is there any like a lot of precedence in terms of which court you can go to?
And yeah, I was about to address that issue. Well, let me go back to Brenna again, because I don't think that we've stated it. What is the issue, according to Rowan or Rogan, whatever it is? What's the issue?
I don't know if I got it right, but I had two. I said, can a law enforcement officer forcibly remove evidence for the person who's gone by any means necessary? And then the other one is, can evidence be entered into the file when it is retrieved verbally without a warrant? That might be pretty different point.
Let's see if we can combine that into one sentence. Because you've separated them out, but I'm not so sure they're separate. So let's try it. Right. How would you combine those two passages?
Maybe to what extent can law enforcement retrieve evidence from a person or from a, I don't know if it's important to specify in this case that it's retrieving it directly from his body, because one of the main points in the case was what's the difference between forcing a confession from someone's mind versus forcing evidence from someone's stomach. So in describing it as an issue, I don't know how broad or specific to make it.
Okay. What specific right is alleged to have been violated here?
14th Amendment.
Okay. Now, in your printing of the issues, I don't think that that appears anywhere.
Okay.
Okay.
In the way you had it formatted, I had those questions of the dispute and then the law. That's why I had it separated as two. Because my first issue was his Fifth Amendment right compromise from the officers extracting the contents. The resulting actions were arguably just to govern from an illegally forced confession. And then the second issue at play was his 14th Amendment right to due process compromise when the unit contained through physical abuse was suspended against him.
Okay. Let me see if we can bring this together. And that's part of sort of framing the issue. The facts are that the government using force without a warrant removed incriminating evidence from the defendant, and he's alleging that that violated his right to due process. Okay. So that's one way to look at it. Another way to look at this would be, should evidence be excluded that was secured by force by the government in violation of the defendant's due process right? Okay, so that's how you bring it all together. Again, still using the facts. Okay, yes?
Is there any preference about that? Because that's the way I went at it, was, is it prohibited by the 14th Amendment?
Yeah, preference is the way I just stated, yes. And that's why I'm uncomfortable with the formatting of the format that they gave you wants you to break this stuff down into all of its components so that you don't overlook anything. But also, rarely do we talk about law in that way. We don't usually take small bites like that. Our analysis may focus on those small bites, but in framing the issue, we want to know what the greater issue is. And in this case, the greater issue, and you may recall that when I said sometimes you can reduce this to a single sentence, it doesn't tell you much about the case, but you can reduce it to a single sentence. And so the single sentence would be, was the defendant's due process rights under the 5th and 14th Amendment violated? Okay. But that could apply to damn near anything. And so we need the facts from this particular case woven into that statement in order to really understand what was going on in this case. So that when you frame the issue, generally speaking, should be framed in a way that's peculiar to that particular case. Okay? It shouldn't. Will it have general applicability? Yes. But you know, these are the relevant facts that raise the particular issue. And you want to make sure that you identify the rule that you believe has been violated. Okay, so we've had the facts, the procedural history. We now have the issue. And when we talk about the issue, is we're saying there's a question on the floor. And the question on the floor is whether all of this stuff, when we look at it, violated defendant's rights to the extent that the evidence ought to be excluded from trial. Okay. What we're talking about, and next year, in the first semester, you'll spend more time on criminal procedure. And but this is our introduction to what is called the exclusionary rule. And the exclusionary rule, you get exclusionary rules in all kinds of things, but we're talking about in the context of the Constitution. This is our introduction to the exclusionary rule. And so the defendant is arguing that under an exclusionary, which says the government cannot use this evidence because it was obtained illegally, should it be applicable. And next year you'll talk about the reasons why there's an exclusionary rule. But what's great about the due process cases is that you can see one of the reasons rather easily. What do you think the justification for having an exclusionary rule on our facts, why would it make sense? It's a practical matter. We don't need to think like a lawyer. Just as an ordinary person, why does it make sense to have an exclusionary rule?
Checks itself.
Okay, that's one of those legalese that doesn't take me anywhere. Okay, so, talk to me. What is it that you're trying to say?
Trying to say that if police, the government had free rein to get whatever they wanted from you by land, whatever means possible, then you, we as citizens would have no protection.
Okay. Now, would you agree with me that those are two different statements?
Well, shorthand.
Shorthand for what? How does that make it unique to this case? The shorthand wouldn't answer the question. The longer version does. Okay? So what we're talking about is discouraging unlawful conduct by the police. The hope is that if they can't get a conviction, then they won't intentionally violate the rights of a citizen. That presupposes some things that I'm not sure it's appropriate to presuppose, but it does. It presupposes that a police officer is acting in good faith and doesn't want to violate the law. And since he or she doesn't want to violate the law, then they want to do it the right way. And so that's the justification for it. Now, in answer to your question, and I apologize for taking so long to get back to you, as we go through the cases, the first 2 weeks, I believe, I sometimes lose my mind as I'm doing this. Actually, I think it's the first week. The first week, we focus on constitutional issues. Where a constitutional claim is raised, it can be raised in state court or federal court. Because this arrest was made by a state official, the first place to raise the claim will be in state court. Okay? If it turns out that the state fails to interpret or to apply the Constitution properly, then you have two avenues of appeal. You can appeal in the state court system, and people usually do. So that's what we call a vertical appeal. Or you can launch what is called a collateral attack. And that's where you would say, my rights were violated in the state court, so I'm going to go to the federal court and have the federal court vindicate my rights. But you can only do that where a state defendant is arguing that a federal constitutional right has been violated. And so that's specifically what happens here. And so that's how this matter gets to the U.S. Supreme Court so easily. Because the U.S. Supreme Court has the responsibility to interpret the United States Constitution. Okay. So does that answer your question? Okay, yeah. Okay, so we've got the issue, the facts. The next thing we need to talk about, what's the answer? Because essentially the issue is a question. What's the answer to the question? I'll tell you people to shut up if they don't shut up in a minute. Tell them I said hold it down. So, what's the answer to the question? No, you listen, you volunteered for the hot seat tonight, so
you're
after
this.
Yeah.
Okay. So I said in the issue for the facts, I said however murky the differences can state to state in style and enthusiasm for enforcing narcotics offenses. Supreme Court ruling determined that the move is brutality demonstrated by the officers in this case which offended even hardened sensibility.
And thus?
And thus, the, I said, having no warrant to enter the home or reasonable means to retrieve the capsules, which became the primary evidence in this case, the officers in this case did not ensure proper due process in carrying the evidence to court. So, I said, it was about...
You said a mouthful.
I know, I...
So, try to reduce that to a sentence or two in terms of what is the holding of this case?
The narrow holding or the broad holding?
The narrow holding.
The narrow holding. Law enforcement officials may not physically force evidence from suspect a criminal through cruel and unusual means. Such evidence may not be admissible by virtue of violating the 14th Amendment right to due process.
Thank you, amen. Can I get an amen? All right, so that's the holding of the case. Now, everything else will be focusing on the rationale for that. But that's actually the rule of law from this particular case, is that government officials cannot use brutal force to secure evidence on a person and then introduce that at trial against them. Because that's a violation of due process. What is it that due process, according to this case, seems to protect us from or for? Yeah.
This is my case.
Yeah, you own it. You'll never forget it.
If they the right to due process for not self-incriminating with releasing the that would be more fit, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, that's. I guess we need to address that issue. This is a combined, part of the reason that I began with due process, there was actually a reason, there was a method to my madness. Whenever we talk about the exclusion of evidence, the due process clause can be used to exclude evidence that is self-incriminating, that was obtained without a warrant, or can be used to reverse a conviction where there was ineffective assistance of counsel. So the right to counsel wasn't protected. So the due process clause, and this is, we're talking procedural due process right now. Procedural due process goes across the board when we talk about exclusion of evidence, okay? So it can be used to exclude physical evidence as well as our oral statements. And we'll find it can also be used to exclude identification evidence. So it's this wonderful tool that can be used across the board. The problem with it is that it is sort of fact, it indeed is fact-based. And so let's dig into the language used in this case to talk about what kinds of facts do you need in order to trigger a discussion of a violation of due process. What kind of facts do you need?
You need to know how
they were obtained. Okay, so you need to know how it was obtained. Why is that important?
Because if it were, if the person has no sense of protection, as you had said earlier, that, you know, if it could be taken from any citizen by any means necessary, or any means no matter how brutal, then we don't have any kind of sense of civil order.
Okay.
The government can just take any kind of evidence by any means.
Okay. So this concept of procedural due process embodies this notion of that we've got these rules, there is this concept of fairness. Specifically, when you talk about due process, you must look for some illegal, outrageous act on the part of the government. Okay? So there's going to have to be government conduct before one can argue that there's been a violation of due process. And so the government conduct in this case is A, forcing your way into a person's home without a warrant, B, slamming them down on bed, floor, or whatever, and trying to extract evidence from their body, C, you then drag the person to a hospital where you have their stomach pumped, and then not only do you pump it, you take that evidence and you have it analyzed. And then you say, voila, we have drugs. Generally speaking, due process is triggered by that. Go away, guy. That's actually his name. So we're looking for outrageous conduct on the part of the government. And so you're going to need to be able to describe that conduct with some specificity. Yes?
I have a question, actually. In terms of, see that, for example, the drug trafficking cases, we have them putting the caps of cocaine and heroin off their premises.
You mean planting it?
Right. So say, for example, the government is the information that somebody is carrying it. What gives them the right to be able to do, to perform a search like that, or just to, which is very similar to this versus not?
I mean, what gives the government the right to plant evidence?
No, to extract evidence from a body.
She means somebody has
to have a drug cavity.
Yeah.
Or hide in a body cavity to get it across.
Well, I mean, that is the question. You've alleged government conduct or misconduct, and you're also beginning to get a sense of what is the difficulty with due process analysis. Where do we draw the line? Okay? It's fact-driven. And so the police walk away from this not necessarily knowing when a particular set of facts have gone too far or haven't gone far enough. The court has actually been pretty consistent in saying that you can't extract something from a person's insides. Now, it's different from patting them down in their clothing. But when something is becomes part of their body, you can't usually do that without some kind of prior approval. And we say that it sort of offends our decency, our sense of order. It's important to understand the historical basis of our Constitution. Our Constitution was written by people who felt that they were abused by the British government. They had soldiers coming into their homes without notice and essentially ransacking their homes, taking them away to Guantanamo without any court order, isolating them for hours at a time. And so with due process cases, the question becomes, well, how much time did you isolate them? How awful was the extraction? one of the things that you'll read next year is Winston versus Lee, where there's a guy who's got a bullet in him, and the police want to get the bullet so that they can show that he was involved in something on the basis of ballistics analysis. And the court says you can't do that without a warrant. And the other complication was that in securing this evidence, Mr. Winston, there was some danger that removal of the bullet would cause permanent bodily harm to him. And so the court said we need a warrant. That's one extreme. So that was a violation of due process plus the right against unlawful search and seizures. But what we're looking for when we talk about procedural due process is fairly outrageous conduct on the part of the police. The less outrageous, the less likely one is going to be successful in arguing violation of due process. But what are some of the factors when we talk about outrageous? Well, did the government happen to violate another aspect of the Constitution in doing whatever it is that they were doing? That will be one factor. Another factor will be how much physical abuse did the defendant have to go through? Another factor might be, well, what rights were at stake? And how fundamental, how important to our system of justice are those, or were those rights? So those are all things. And then what are the consequences where the rights have been violated? You know, if it's a fine, then maybe the court will say, under due process, no big deal. But where there's incarceration, and perhaps incarceration for a significant period of time, they say, well, slow down. The analysis that we are talking about is referred to as a totality of the circumstances test for due process. The totality of the circumstances. Now, what I've just given you is the test that the court applies in due process cases. But it would take the court another 40 years to actually articulate that as the test. Okay? So that's Rogan. Any questions about it? Yes?
Concurring opinion, the justice to say that that it was the Fifth Amendment that should have been the basis of the reversal. I don't understand.
She's not here. She's downstairs.
I don't understand that because it's I don't understand how he would have incriminated himself because he made himself vulnerable or anything. They made him vulnerable. So
Good for you. The Fifth Amendment applies to statements. And at the time that this case was decided, the court hasn't quite worked that out either. And so there today you wouldn't say that was a Fifth Amendment violation because the evidence speaks for itself. The defendant isn't actually speaking. Okay, and so the focus of the Fifth Amendment tends to be on what words came out of the defendant's mouth as opposed to what evidence did you extract from the defendant. And so, but you should read concurring and dissenting opinions because sometimes those concurring and dissenting opinions will become majority opinions later on. He was on to something, but he wasn't quite on the mark. This particular opinion is offered by former Harvard professor Felix Frankfurter, who is viewed as one of the writer members of the court. Progressive, but not crazy liberal. So, and the, was it Sutherland who filed the concurring opinion?
No, it was, I think it was Black and Douglas. You go along the word Douglas?
Yeah. Douglas is a liberal, and Douglas, but sometimes Douglas's liberal leanings would get in the way of him understanding what he was really talking about. What Douglas is objecting to is that this evidence, if allowed, is essentially a statement. He's equating it with a statement. He loses that fight in the end, but he will make that argument in subsequent cases as well. When it comes to the Fourth and the Fifth Amendment relates to statements as opposed to evidence. And statements, in fact, sometimes you can have implied statements, that is by conduct, but the evidence itself is not a statement. Hugo Black becomes an important sort of swing vote in terms of these cases at that particular hearing. Part of what you'll get in reading these due process cases is you're going to get a history lesson in American jurisprudence, because we start very early and sort of move on. I want to talk about Powell versus Alabama, which is the second case, and I've got this rule where I don't keep people for the entire time for their first class, and so I want to stick with it. How many of you, I know that you all were so nervous about the first day of school that you didn't do this, but did any of you happen to see the Tony Awards last night? See? It was...
Basketball, you're finally
wrong. Okay. One of the musicals nominated for Tony was the Scottsboro Boys. The musical. This case is the basis for that musical. And this, what you have is, in the musical, it's a sort of reenactment of some of what led up to the man being arrested. And it's a period in American history where people illegally ride the rails. We call them hobos. People would jump on a freight car, sneak in, and go for as far as they could, for as long as they could. These nine men get into a freight car, and there are other people in the car as well. So it must have been the most accessible freight car. I believe that there are several white men, and for sure two white women. The nine black men and the white males get into a fight. I don't know the extent of the fight, but when the train pulls into its next stop, one of the white men gets off the train and tells the sheriff that there are black men on the train who are sexually assaulting white women. Two white women. So when they pull into Scottsboro, Alabama, the posse is waiting for them, and they are arrested. And the case gives you the rest of the facts. They have a trial. And who are they represented by a trial?
Nobody.
Everybody at the bar.
Everybody at the bar. Who happens to be?
Nobody.
And I don't mean in a pejorative sense. It happens to be a lawyer who, in fact, had never tried a criminal case in his life, and now was suddenly representing 9 different defendants. There wasn't much time to investigate, interview, or have any conversation with the clients. The case is rammed through in terms of trial, and the whole thing, I think, doesn't take more than a day, if only a few hours. So they are arrested, tried, and convicted in short order. And so they argue that I've got a right to an effective assistance of counsel, that it's a violation of due process under the 14th Amendment to try and convict me without representation. And I didn't have any representation there. The case doesn't make it clear, but some of the men are sentenced to death, some are sentenced to life in prison, the Supreme Court reverses the conviction, believing that indeed this offends our sense of ordered liberty. The illegal act in this case, to some extent, is actually perpetrated by the court, but the court is also an arm of the government. To some extent, what the U.S. Supreme Court is saying is that the state of Alabama, as it is represented by the judge and the jury in this case, they have not done their jobs properly, because these folks did not have an opportunity for a fair trial. And that is one of the fundamental values of our country, that everyone is entitled to a fair trial. And so that's why you get the outcome in Powell. So, again, the test is assuming there was some government misconduct, can one argue that under the totality of the circumstances that their rights have been violated? And the Supreme Court says yes. Everybody's entitled to a fair trial, and there wasn't a fair trial here. Yes.
So does that mean, so who's on trial then for the U.S. court hearing? Because it seems that they're not in any way dealing with the alleged assault in this case.
They're not.
They're
not.
So is the Alabama court on trial?
As far as the Supreme Court is concerned, yes. The state of Alabama is on trial.
And the fact that it was reversed, does that then let the boys off, or does that allow them to have a new trial, or what is?
Good question.
And the amount of time that went by, was the sentence already carried out?
The answer to the question is no, the sentence was not carried out. Keep in mind, the allegation is the rape of a white woman by black men. And so in many areas of the country at that particular time, that was a death. The punishment was death. And so the only thing that happens with this reversal is that they get a new trial. At the second, at subsequent trials, they are convicted again. And your event is in 23, is that correct? 22, 23?
32. Oh, 31.
31.
And then, that's why I was curious. The speed at which it went through, and it wasn't then brought to the Supreme Court until a year later.
That's fast. I mean, that's, I mean, it's, you will find that it is unusual for cases to get to the United States Supreme Court that fast.
So they would sustain the death sentence until?
They stayed the death sentences, that's correct. That's, and that's part of the reason it was so fast, because in Alabama at that particular point, the sentence would have been carried out probably within a week or two of the conviction. And so the United States Supreme Court had to intervene, was asked to intervene quickly. What is not, what you're not told in terms of this case is that the NAACP hears about the trial, and they send attorneys to Alabama, and a number of other human rights organizations hear about this, and they all converge on Alabama, and they all file amicus briefs that are friendly briefs asking the court to set aside the convictions. Once the Powell versus Alabama is decided, some of those people leave and are no longer interested in the case. Many of them are retried, I don't believe any of them are ever executed, although there was a great danger of them. But some of them ended up spending virtually the rest of their lives in jail. The story gets further complicated by the fact that there actually was no sexual assault. The victim, the alleged victim in the case, recants. And recants, that is, takes back her statement relatively early in the process. And so the real crime was a white woman voluntarily being in the same small space with black men. And so to uphold the virtue of the white women, even though the people of Alabama did not believe that the women had much virtue, but to uphold that virtue, this thing traveled, lasted for many, many years. And there are a bunch of people who, I think the last of the people to be released was a guy named Weems. I think the youngest of them gets off and gets out earliest, but I'm not entirely sure of the chronology. What I do know is that the matter was still being litigated through the 40s. So some of these folks stayed in prison through the 1940s. And I'll close with this because we've done enough for tonight, and I want to stay true to my as lawyers, you are empowered to do, or will be empowered to do, extraordinary things. And one of those extraordinary things is that you can be the only person in the world to stand up for the rights of another human being. And in fact, in the Scottsboro case, after the Supreme Court is out of the picture, there was one African-American lawyer who none of us had ever heard of. And I can't even remember his first name. I know his last name, though. So a guy named Scipio. And he stays with these cases because eventually the NAACP is sort of chased out of town because of politics. This is also at the time when communism is running rampant in Europe, and so some of the labor industries were involved, so they abandoned these defendants, and so the only person to stay throughout is this guy named Scipio, and he works this for the next 20 years. So that's the Scottsboro case. That's your first night of law school, and we'll pick it up with the new case on Wednesday. Okay? Thank you.